We're an advocate, and we're advocates for effective programming. This is why we did this study in the first place. We're interested to know what works, what doesn't work. Stuff that does work, how do we get it out into the hands of people who actually can make it work? And then the stuff that doesn't work, how can we politely take that back, retool it, and then get it back out? We're advocates for translational research as well. Translational research meaning that we want to go from more descriptive research to more analytic research. We're trying to see what the evidence is, how strong the evidence is, and then get that out again into the hands of the providers. We're for translational research in terms of bridging the clinical and public health world. I think we're kind of islands upon ourselves. Through this joint work together, we can kind of get the best outcomes possible. So we're advocating for that. The last thing that we're advocating for, and this is going to go right into the presentation, is this, that we're trying to bridge the evidence and the outreach gap. What's being produced in the laboratories or theoretical discussions sometimes is not appropriately or effectively getting out into the hands of the providers. What that's doing is there's a lot of ineffective that I can speak to from our research and with TSE particularly. What's being shown to be effective is not really sometimes it's not being executed in the community. And what that's leading to is a waste of resources almost, if you want to be crass about it. So that's what we did this study about. It was a systematic review of interventions promoting TSE among at-risk males. In the past 20 years, I'll go into like the whole methodology about it, but it was me, Chase Caballero, he was a student of mine before, he's now a second-year med student. Jim and another gentleman, Steve Harlan, did his paper. There's no financial conflicts to state, so we're good, hopefully.
Want to do this one? Okay. So good afternoon, good overview by Mike there. So I'm going to speak to you briefly about more the genesis of how this came up, obviously our thesis, and open it up more for just some thought, just some good cogitation. So what comes to mind as you read through the slide there is oftentimes in men's health, we kind of have this perspective of the forest and the trees. So all of us are in the forest, right? We're wandering around. We have our excellent programs. We are doing good work, right? I think that first should be acknowledged. As I was talking with Mike earlier, I'm a big advocate of a strengths-based model, not a deficit model. And I think some opportunities in men's health really needs to focus more on what are we doing well and how do we actually, as Mike said, turn the tide a little bit, right? Retool some stuff, tweak some things. So I would encourage all of us to kind of rethink of how do we see the forest among the trees instead of just being in the trees. So as you can see here, there is a very limited discussion on the validity of interventions at promoting testicular self-performance. So, you know, the justification is there. We looked at a lot of the literature out there. And again, we do a lot, but the question that always comes up, at least in my mind, is what is the end game? What's our end product here? So the existing body of evidence is kind of all over the place, and I think we found that through our systematic review. Obviously, keeping policy in mind is very important, so Healthy People 2020. And as was introduced by Lee as well, there's a lot of implications for how we are to leverage recent decisions with the United States Preventative Task Force on their downgrading of testicular cancer interventions. So our primary arguments excuse me, are based upon kind of these two camps, if you think about it, right, with anything. We have our anti-TSE, not to say that these providers or these people, these groups that make recommendations are against health. I think that's one of the first things we have to understand the rhetoric. It's not being against it. It's looking, as Mike said, at effectiveness. And of course, and I'll speak to this in a moment, false positives are important in public health, right? We need to know the sensitivity, specificity, positive predictive value, negative predictive. But there's also unintended benefit that comes along with raising anxiety, raising consciousness, not fear-based, but making a person say, you know what, where am I on the spectrum here? There's also lack of clinical trials demonstrating the abilities of testicular self-examination in reducing mortality. So just in brief, and I'll kind of go off an offshoot here, anxiety can translate to action. Most of us, if you're anxious, you're going to do something. Why? It's an autonomic response. You either freeze or you do something. So I'm not trying to combat the first example there, but I think maybe we can reshape this into an opportunity, as Mike said, for further discovery. Men often are less engaged. There was a presentation earlier in terms of expressing oneself, a concept called alexithymia. So sometimes maybe just getting at the gut reaction of a guy and his loved ones could kind of spark a little bit more of a discussion, whether internal dialogue or not. So what Mike and I were talking about is kind of this portal of access. And testicular self-exams are certainly a possibility for that. Now, of course, on the pro-testicular self-exam side, we do see some evidence. You know, they can raise the awareness where we do have even a small group of men who say, you know what, if I wasn't taught this, if I wasn't exposed to this, perhaps I wouldn't be able to have found an early stage cancer at the best, or at least being aware of something. So we really need to work on increasing, again, knowledge. And when we do find things work, there is a relative cost-benefit analysis to this. So, again, the genesis of our evidence. The existing evidence, I'll be brief with this one as well. We looked at the analytical designs in this systematic review, and as it says, there's lots of stuff, but they're kind of over more into the educational side. There's lack of evidence showing what does it actually do. So our attempt was to come up with a cohesive summary that really does access performance and behavior, because most of us out there are sitting there saying, how does the needle change? How are we showing actual results? What is that end game process? So I'll let Mike kind of talk more about the methodological stuff, and I'll wrap up with some concluding thoughts.
Just to highlight on the cost-benefit analysis, there's a paper that we cited, A. Berger et al. From 2014. They made a case for conducting TSC using a cost-benefit analysis, and they said this, that it's a 2.4-to-1 cost-benefit ratio that exists for a case of testicular cancer caught early versus a more advanced discovery. It really is in our best interest in terms of monetary resources and funds to really promote this just from the cancer detection perspective. But what I was trying to get at before was, in the past 30 years, there may have been, and I'll show you here, 10 studies, 10 interventions that said, here's a message, I'm going to condense it. Here's a message, guys listen to the message. Did the guys perform TSC, yes or no? Guys report that the message was effective or not in me actually performing TSC. I think that, and I'll go into this a little bit, but the field for us was flooded with descriptive research. It was flooded with research that just said, do you intend to do this? And that's great. But we're interested in people actually doing something. There's so much intention research, but it's not going to the next step and saying this works because they said it worked, not just intending to do it. So there was maybe 10 or so studies in the past 25, 30 years probably, since the early 80s, that actually had a message, a campaign, do you do this, yes or no, and then they judge effectiveness from that. So that's what we're stemming from with this review. Literally found 10. There's only 10. In 30 years of research, 10, with testicular cancer being the number one killer for the most part in adolescent males, cancer, that's a little bit alarming. We had a whole screening process. It was pretty standard screening, abstract review, you know, full articles for relevance, and I'm not going to go into the nitty-gritty with it, a systematic review, but there's a whole tertiary screening process. We kind of narrowed it down to 10 that fit our criteria. For the most part, though, was the outcome measure of interest, did you do or did you not do TSE? This is the primary variables that we extracted from the data, and this is what you got to do to really look at effectiveness. I think we should preach this more among all public. These reviews should be almost standard before you go out and actually conduct some kind of campaign. We should all be doing this. What's the source citation, the sample size? That's critical. If you're doing a campaign with 10 people, I mean, what's the validity in that? Sample size. We had a summary content. We had a theoretical framework, if it was present, and we're advocating that it should be framed in some kind of established theory or model. That's also very important. We had the primary outcomes and a significance level, and then key weaknesses of the design. Summing all up, we had found 10. There was one that was high quality. Now, we used the Downs and Black tool for assessing intervention quality. That's a standard tool that most of us use, that or the Pedro scale, but we use Downs and Black. One was high quality, The rest were average. You can see some of the average were bordering on low quality. And there's reasons for that, but that's what the evidence is saying, that these interventions, that people are still kind of using the theories of these, they're bordering on low quality. Not to take anything away from their science, but for them personally, but still. What we found out, some concerns, there's lack of any kind of follow-up longer than 6 months. So it's pretty much like, here, here's my message. Did you do it? Cool. 2 weeks later, you still good? Yeah, we're good. And there's nothing else after that. There's no long-term follow-up. What's important for behavioral change, obviously, is at least 6 months and then go forward. 1 year, 2 year follow-up is paramount. There's not very well disseminated to the general population at all. Consistency and validity of sample sizes was very much a factor. Attrition was huge. They weren't really even monitoring attrition at all. They had 500 guys, great, 150 finished. That's 350 that just vanished. Is something significant about that? Probably, but they're not factoring that in. That definitely influences generalizability and reliability, of course. Lack of random selection and allocation, that's hard to achieve, and I get that in public health, but that was a factor. Diverse sampling pool, they're mostly white. 80% were white. Although this is the most at-risk population, and a lot of the articles did discuss this as being a limitation, we need to start branching out to other populations as well. What we did was create a guideline and best practices recommendation. Number one, we couldn't really say that one campaign was more effective than the other. Out of those 10, there wasn't really one that was overwhelmingly, wow, we should all go to this, you know, and preach this. There's not one. And there's various reasons why. Tons of error was present in every design. There was a varying number of outcomes that were being measured, sometimes not even synonymously. What an outcome was for TSC was pretty much dichotomized as yes or no in a self-report, which is a problem, but there's a lot of systematic error. Sample selection was a huge problem. Self-report data was a huge problem. So we couldn't really say that, yes, this one is the ticket. Number two, they need some kind of valid methodology for sampling. It was completely random. It was heterogeneous at its finest. It was just all over the place. We should strive to get a more random sample, if possible, and then randomly allocate to treatment groups. But I get sometimes that is difficult to achieve. Number three was they were providing incentives, but they were for some reason the incentives were not preventing attrition. So they enrolled all these men in the study, but they had a lot of people follow, a lack of follow-up. So there's got to be some kind of different approach to incentivizing these young men to stay in a study. More representative sample population, and we need to more innovative ways to measure TSC. What we were going to suggest is, and I'm turning over to Jim right now, is yes, it's yes or no, but what they're suggesting is if a guy says yes in a self-report, maybe he's lying, maybe he's not. If those that say yes, have them actually perform on a model if they could find a life-size model, if they could actually find the lumps on the model, because if they're saying yes and they're continually do it, then the execution efficacy of their practice would be paramount. But turn over to Jim.
Okay, so I'll bring you some kind of concluding, wrapping up thoughts here as far as, and I'm just sitting here kind of listening to where's this at. So we clearly have problematic literature. One of the things to think about, though, is problematic literature doesn't necessarily mean there are problems with the things that we're recommending to our young boys and men regarding this topic. There's a under-reporting bias that probably exists. There are probably programs out there that do not have, you know, a very methodologically sound literature because, as we know, clinicians and practitioners are doing the stuff. So they may not have the time to report on what they're finding, which could be some pretty good stuff. So please keep that in mind. The first, you know, where do we go from here? So there was a presentation yesterday on gamification, you know, engaging males in different ways that really can kind of spark interest, whether it's reproductive health. This obviously could very finely mesh with reproductive health sciences. So, you know, our colleagues in those areas could be very supportive and useful. We need a comprehensive approach. And as Mike just mentioned, proper sampling is important. If we are going to take this, we should take this more towards how do we actually make this work. Thank you. Appreciate that. Sorry, that's a reference slide. So as it says there, you know, and Mike did bring this up, theory is important. You know, we can do a lot of things, but we really need to understand the motivation. We need to use theory to drive a lot of these programs. And as we found in the literature, if it is there, it's not well understood. It's not well defined by a lot of the researchers, if they're using it at all. So again, a very systematic problem in the process. So future research, using a lot of these possibilities, are encouraging, I would say. There are benefits beyond, and this is kind of our next stages, if you're wondering kind of where we're taking this. Conversations are important. Having the opportunity to dialogue and discuss, where do these interventions lead you? Yes, it might invoke fear, anxiety, but it also prompts action. We need better opportunities to have those dialogues with young men to help them navigate the healthcare system. And there's a lot of things that we kind of take for granted. So younger men in particular are often a silent crowd for different reasons, biological reasons, sociocultural reasons. So how do we allow them to express their voice, not give them a voice, not empower them, but let them understand and kind of discover their own bodies, their own minds, their own approaches? I think that's kind of from my own perspective, that's kind of the key basis for what we're trying to do here, is allow that self-efficacy to rise out of the person, not do a bunch of interventions, a bunch of medical-based interventions to see if they work, right? Because it can work for a person. It's more important, at least in my opinion, to allow the person to understand the value in which they're interacting in the healthcare system, whether it go from testicular exams all the way through the sociocultural context. And lastly, we also need to understand this more so from race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, and kind of looking at the stratifying results here. So I'll conclude with, you know, we do have the e-publication out right now that's appearing in the American Journal of Men's Health, if you'd like to get more into the methodological approaches that we took with this study. I think future directions will need to look at how this can be viewed as an opportunity, again, to advance male health and personal health, and at least understanding the evidence is an opportunity for us to look to what that direction might be. So on behalf of Mike, well, thank you, and we'll hold off for questions a little bit later. Thank you.